you might have a $2,000 sale being held up on the lack of a $10 part, right? And that was starting to become a pretty major challenge for me, and it caused me to really, kind of dig in and look at how the contract electronics manufacturing market worked. And what I started to notice is there was a pretty big misalignment between the needs and the way that the manufacturers have to run themselves and the needs of the customer.
Welcome to the Manufacture Houston podcast, where Houston's manufacturers come to share, learn, and grow. Brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com.
In today's episode, we talk to Chris Church, who's the founder and chief product officer of Macrofab, Houston's leading electronics contract manufacturing business. Chris walks us through his long-range thinking and how he was able to transform an idea into one of the most dynamic manufacturing businesses around. I know you'll love today's episode.
Chris, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Mush.
Absolutely. It's so good to hear your voice. You and I were just talking offline about when we saw each other last. That was at least about 18 months ago.
Yeah, well, it's nice to actually, even if we're just, online here,
right.
Nice to see other humans.
No kidding. Yeah, I was joking with you about how this reminds me of the Avengers and the blip, like everybody disappeared. And now we're slowly rematerializing back into life. So.
Yeah, I think everyone's ready for us to get back into a little bit of normalcy,
Indeed.
Even if it's still a bit away, everybody's still hoping at this point.
That's right. Yeah. So I'm so excited to have you on the Manufacture Houston podcast, Chris. And I know that you've been grinding away in Macrofab world and manufacturing world for a long time. And I'd love to kick off just to hear more about you and your background. And then let's talk about the Macrofab origin story and just sort of catching us up to where Macrofab is today.
Yeah, absolutely. So a little background on myself. So I've been, kind of in the software space for, gosh, a little over 20 years now. Started my career out in networking, working for a lot of ISPs in the mid 90s. Transitioned over into startups, did some time with Questia, which I think was one of the first Houston unicorns, being as a tech lead on the workflow automation team there. But ultimately ended up getting together with some friends of mine that I'd worked with a couple companies prior. And we started this little company a few people might've heard of here in Houston called Alert Logic. And we were one of the first successful software as a service cybersecurity firms out there. And served as chief architect there for about 9 years, really kind of leading a lot of our, automation technology and threat detection. We had a really good run. I really enjoyed, working with that team there and seeing the company grow. I think, we started with what, six of us. And then by the time I left, we were at about 150 people. And then I think at one point I heard they had 750 employees, right? So got quite large there. But, I ended up leaving Alert Logic, not because there was anything wrong with the company, but I had this other little idea that was one of those right time, right places. I had, really gotten into robotics for a while and ended up developing a motion control system for filmmakers that was kind of a low cost alternative to some of the systems they were dealing with out there, and started this company called Dynamic Perception. And, we built, sort of robots for cameras, basically. And a couple of the shining moments, I think we had there, if anyone's ever seen that show, I know it's not very popular, you haven't heard much about it, called House of Cards. The whole intro sequence of that was shot with our equipment. And then I think when the Pixel phone came out, they shot the video with the phone there with our equipment. They even showed a picture of it up on the stage. That was kind of fun to see. But we did a lot of business with the cable companies and stuff. So that was really my, my quick and dirty, how to learn to become a manufacturer, to meet demand as quickly as possible. And so, along the way there, you know, we did a lot of what people had always told us was the right thing to do, right? You're going to start your main, you're going to do your manufacturing in China. So we started in China, like everyone said, and it just really wasn't working out for me, right? We were, you know, very, you know, nimble and agile kind of a manufacturing company. And the idea that stuff is sitting on boats, that I'm, you know, a half a, you know, a whole day away from the people who are building my products really wasn't making a lot of sense to me. So when we did a lot of analysis on that, we found that we could actually save money by bringing that manufacturing back to the US. So we did. And, you know, now I found I had a new set of problems. You know, we had a pretty large library of products we had to build, or SKUs, you might say. And, you know, I think at one point we had like 130 SKUs we were managing. And you might have a $2,000 sale being held up on the lack of a $10 part, right? Mm-hmm. And that was starting to become a pretty major challenge for me. And it caused me to really, you know, kind of dig in and look at how the contract electronics manufacturing market worked. And what I started to notice is there was a, you know, pretty big misalignment between the needs and the way that the manufacturers have to run themselves and the needs of the customer. And one of the more particular ones here is that, you know, when we think about a contract manufacturer of any sort, whether it's electronics or machining, kind of anything else, they tend to have a fixed amount of capacity, right? That there are, if you think about it at the end of the day, you buy all this capital equipment, you invest all this money, and, you know, doubling your capacity is not just hiring twice as many workers, right? You have to make a pretty substantial investment in new equipment, new facilities perhaps, and it's not really cheap to go out there and add a lot more capacity. So what we were finding is that we as a customer, we're getting a lot of great attention when a manufacturer we were working with had a lot of excess capacity. But as they were getting bigger customer, bigger deals, we were having trouble really kind of getting that ongoing production. So, you know, I stopped and I looked at this and I really said, you know, there's got to be a different way to do this, right? You know, I come from the cloud computing world, you know, I've developed services for AWS and, you know, done a lot of this other stuff. And I know, you know, in the manufacturing world, we talk about scalability, right? Which is how do we, you know, how do our customers grow with us? How do they spend more money, produce, you know, higher volumes of products? But what we don't tend to talk about a lot is elasticity, right? The customers really need elasticity. They all believe, you know, everyone believes they're going to get bigger and sell more products, right? But imagine this world where, you know what, something really big happens out there in the marketplace, say maybe a virus comes out, a pandemic, and
that would never happen.
Never happen. And your customers pull back a little bit, right? And so you need a little less product than you needed before right now. And then maybe those customers come back and then you need a lot more product than you were just producing. This is that elasticity we're talking about. Well, the market didn't really seem to be in a position to support that kind of elasticity. So ultimately ended up selling that business to go focus on the customer experience and enabling elasticity in contract manufacturing. And that is, you know, basically the very short condensed origin story of MacroFab, right? Which is basically, how do we make something like AWS for electronics?
All right. So I got lots of questions, Chris. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that intro. It's a hell of an intro. But my first sort of question that jumped into my head is that you went from this security company, AlertLogic, to making robots for cameras, and now you're in contract electronic manufacturing. So what's the thread that goes through all of that stuff for you personally? Or is it that just you wake up every day, dream up something new, and you do it? Maybe it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. And, you know, I guess it's one that people don't often ask me a lot. They ask me, well, how did you end up there? Which is a different question than how are those things connected? So I think we can connect them all for me personally in that they are long-running challenges. You know, they're not overnight projects. I'm not the kind of person who gets really excited about things that can be done quickly. You know, when I you know, we often talk about my personal projects at home with my wife and sometimes with my friends. You know, they'll talk about, you know, that project I started 3 years ago and I'm still working on, right? Those are the things I really enjoy, things that you can really get into and dive into, spend a lot of time that you're not going to find early success. You really have to commit yourself to it. I'm just the guy who likes really big, complicated things that take a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how I end up here, right?
Glutton for punishment.
Yeah. Well, I think the problem space is more interesting when you have to spread that solution out over years, right? Because the problem will change as you're working on it, as you learn more information, as you build more technology, right? And I think it's really interesting to kind of prove out, you know, assumptions you make a decade earlier in your life, right? To come in there and say, hey, look, you know, what was I thinking then? How can I change my thinking about it now and really learn from that?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Chris. And I love this idea of digging into long running challenges, because I think we're in that environment now where there's great opportunity for the people like yourself who are willing to dig in. Mm-hmm. You also said something about as you started out, everybody said you got to make in China. That was, you know, speaking of assumptions and changing your thinking. Mm-hmm. So you alluded to the idea of costs being not what you expected, and not necessarily just per unit cost, but other types of costs. Right. Tell us a bit more about your experience when you made the switch from making things in China to figuring out how to make things more locally.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we got to dive in there first and what we mean by cost, because I think a lot of people are, and, you know, it's not that they're not intelligent enough to know this, but it's really easy to focus in on one area of cost. It's really easy to capture that. And they tend to look at the cost of production, for example, right? What is my unit price from that manufacturer, including my materials, labor, et cetera. But when you start to consider other secondary and tertiary costs on top of that, whether it's the shipping fees, the support costs, like, you know, do you have to have people awake at 2 o'clock on a Sunday morning to catch that manufacturer in time before they're starting their next shift change, right? There's actually additional cost on your workers to have them, you know, working out of their normal band of time, right? They get less productive, they're less available for the rest of the team. And then when we think about if there's an issue and you have to go fly over to China to go resolve that, to sit on the manufacturing line, if you're sending your director, or your VP, or someone who leads your manufacturing out to do that, what's the opportunity cost of them spending a week with like 2 days of that literally on the plane out there doing that? So we tend to break that out. I tend to call that whole thing there the total cost of ownership of that product. And let's not even imagine when you're shipping, you got 6 months of product sitting on a boat in a container for 6 weeks. Well, that's inventory of yours that's not moving. That's capital you have tied up on a boat that you can't even sell at this moment, right? And what's the cost of that capital? Right. How much are you borrowing? Or, you know, if you're a venture backed company, right, you know, how much of your company have you sold for that capital that's now sitting there? Right. That can be pretty significant in cost. So when I think about what I'm paying for a product or a solution, I'd like to look at that whole big picture. Right. Where am I losing opportunity cost? You know, where am I trading off opportunity costs, et cetera? And I found, like, in that particular case, as our products were a lower volume product than we might, you know, say we weren't building iPhones, right? We ended up, when we looked at that from a holistic viewpoint, our savings were about 35% to do them in the US at that point.
Interesting, yeah. And so I think that's it's a great insight. And I think you and I could have an entire podcast just on what you just said in the last 120 seconds. And because I think it's valuable for us to think about as we drive for relocalization, that it requires this holistic view on costs beyond what might show up on a spreadsheet. And the other thing you said that was really interesting is that if you're making tens of thousands of something, you know, a cookie cutter type of a product, okay, maybe it makes sense. But if you're making something for a customer or a small group of customers, or you need to be agile and dynamic, then it's an entirely different equation. The next question, or the third question that I popped into my head as you were describing your intro, was a subject that's near and dear to my heart, which is user experience. So I think in the industrial world, certainly, or the B2B world, normal user experience is pretty crappy.
Right.
You know, and we've all been trained on things like ordering things from Uber or Uber Eats or Instacart, where the user experience is way different.
Right.
Tell me a bit more about your thoughts on user experience as it stands today, and how you're at MacroFab really trying to transform user experience with people to do business with you.
Yeah, so that's, you know, when I think about it, so the first thing I want to frame this whole thing with is it was really easy for me to sit here when we were coming up with the idea of MacroFab and say, we're going to make a better user experience, right? We're just going to solve this problem, right? We're software guys. We know this. We got this going on. It is actually a lot more complicated than that. So, you know, we early on, you know, we succeeded in providing a great user experience to you know, a number of levels, right? We certainly had our issues for engineers, right? Because their needs were, I want to stop having to deal with salespeople and my purchasing team. I want to get price quotes when I want my price quotes. That, you know, it was easy to take a person like myself, who at the time was designing products, and, you know, thinking about their costs and, you know, how quickly can I get this turned around and build a better user experience for that kind of, you know, user profile. And we had a lot of early success with that, and it did really well. But the challenge, I think, really comes in, especially when we're talking about B2B companies. You know, it's real easy for an entrepreneur or somebody to say, hey, like, I got a better idea and it's just going to work and they're going to love it and they're all going to flock to it. The reality is that the way sometimes these markets work have gotten that way out of the natural progression and desires and behaviors of both the customer and the vendor, right? So as we started transitioning into providing better experiences for the production teams, the purchasing teams, not just the engineers doing higher volume production for them, what we started to notice is that a lot of your assumptions about what people are willing to do suddenly changed, because it turns out they might actually be somewhat happy with a lot of the stuff they're doing, right? They might have corporate policies that say they have to do it that way. So the transition really turns at when you start doing that, the transition happens here, that you go from saying, how do we remap this experience entirely, to how do we look at and identify the parts the customers like and don't like, and enable them to still have the parts they enjoy or the parts they feel that bring value to them, while eliminating the parts they feel that are nuisances or an issue in their day-to-day life. So that's what we've kind of taken that approach is, as we go, you know, deeper into the organization, we work with, you know, a broader set of customers in the manufacturing space, is not going and saying what they're doing is wrong or it's silly, why do they do this, it costs so much money and adds so much time, but to say, you know what, it got that way for a good reason. Let's go back, identify what those reasons are, and then find all the things they dislike in there, right? Mm-hmm. And focus on those first and foremost, while still giving them the level of control and, you know, some of the aspects that they really wanted to do themselves, still give them the ability to do that.
Yeah, what I love about that is that you're not asking your customers and your users necessarily to make wholesale changes in their behavior, because many of those behaviors, to your point, make sense to them. And there's a business reason or some other reason that that drives them to that point. So I think that's a great way to think about user experience. So I want to dig in more to what MacroFab does. And I've been lucky enough to see it in action. It's a couple of years old. I'm sure it's dramatically different, bigger, more awesome. But tell our listeners exactly what MacroFab is doing every day.
Yeah. So at the very basic level, MacroFab is a digital electronics manufacturing platform. Our customers can come in, upload their design data about their products. We instantaneously price it. We, you know, identify all the materials involved in building that product, and we give them a self-service experience if they want it for electronics manufacturing. Now, on the backside, we work with about 75 factories today, and what we do is we will then place those jobs in the best factory for that customer. And again, this is not a bidding thing, right? This is not the customer is going to get 75 prices. They will tell us the lead time, the quantities, the kind of the quality, you know, metrics they need to hit, and we instantaneously give them a price. We guarantee that price. And then it's our job to put it in the right factory at the right time. Now, that in and of itself sounds, you know, very similar to something like Uber, right? You know, I order a product and, you know, there's someone who's going to deliver that product to me. Now, the difference here changes a little bit in that we are the manufacturer of record for the product. So we are responsible for all the supply chain. We handle all the materials. We guarantee the quality for the customer. We provide engineering support to those factories, et cetera. And kind of at the, you know, if we think about it at the end of the day, it's really about delivering the product and owning as much of the manufacturing challenge for the customer as we can. So our most successful customers will have a number of SKUs that they've, you know, had issues getting produced, typically because their volumes haven't been high enough to attract a lot of attention from the right manufacturers, or they have a lot of instability in their demand. And, you know, we help isolate them from potential changes at the factories, whether it is they've got a new big customer and they no longer have capacity for them, or, you know, there are say supply chain challenges with that factory. There are a lot of different things that can really, you know, impact a customer's outcome with a factory. And it's our job to minimize the possibility of those happening. And we do that by what we call a factory portability capability. That is, we fully digitize the product. We manage all of the work instructions, the quality requirements, et cetera. And then we train those factories in a very rapid manner on how to do that through our platform and our tools.
So this reminds me of a story, and you have to bear with me on this one. I think it connects to what you're describing. When I was a baby engineer, one of my jobs was to buy welding supplies, and I didn't have an idea, still don't have an idea how to buy welding supplies. And so the very nice vendor on the other end coached me through how to buy it. So I didn't have a good understanding of the technical elements, commercial elements of how to even consume that service. Right. It sounds like you're helping to bridge that kind of a gap, and that if I'm a buyer of electronics, I may not know exactly what questions to ask and how to vet a factory and if my design even makes sense, you know,
right.
Is the right kind of design. Am I sort of thinking about this the right way, Chris?
Yeah, that is part of the story. So we do help newer product companies really, you know, take that burden off of them and enable them to effectively manufacture, even though they don't really have that level of experience. But we also provide a lot of value to the organizations that do have a lot of experience. You know, we've had several customers where they're currently working with 10 to 12 different manufacturers, simply because each of their products, you know, that whole set of products that they're building are not a good fit for one manufacturer. So when we think about the life cycle of a product, right? When you're in prototype phase, there are prototype manufacturers. Right. And when you're starting to do your first low volume production runs, you're testing the marketplace, you know, you might be doing a few hundred units at a time, which may actually exceed the capacity of your prototype manufacturer. So you got to go find a new factory and you do this product transition through that. And then when we think about as you're scaling up, you kind of hit all these distinct points where a different manufacturer is going to make sense for you. Maybe at 1,000 units or 10,000 units or 20,000 units. The problem is traditionally, as a consumer of manufacturing, you have to go find qualify, identify, get competitive quotes from, let's say if you need 10 factories, you need to talk to 100 at the end of the day, right? So there's a ton of work involved in that. And as that product, if you kind of think of a, the life cycle of a product is kind of a bell curve, right? So, we're doing this early phase here with this low volume production, and we're ramping into a high volume production. And then as new products are coming out and the market is changing, the volumes you're producing are going further down, 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 till we get down into like maintenance mode, where you're just keeping enough on the shelf to satisfy any warranty requirements. For many of the customers, they're having to manage that entire process themselves. And that's a lot of busy work, right? They're now spending a whole lot of time talking to these factories, requalifying them, kind of doing all that. So that's for the more advanced organization. We enable them to tap into hundreds and hundreds of manufacturing lines, but with one channel, right? Mm-hmm. For their entire catalog, it's one channel to go through. And, a lot of our customers are really starting to see the value of that now in the speed at which they can operate, because they don't have to go through this whole process on every single product every time it changes.
Yeah, that makes sense. So MacroFab must be developing some pretty incredible intelligence about both buyers and sellers, I would imagine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's actually part of our secret sauce, is our platform can look at a design from, down to the individual component level, and it can in real time can actually map it to the factories which are capable of building that on a number of different factors, right? Not only do we know the types of equipment and processes they support, but we also get real-time feedback into their quality and their performance and their on-time delivery. And that is also tied to individual product designs. So we're able to actually say that even though on the books, a particular manufacturer looks perfectly capable of doing this, this product, we know from similar products they have built in the past, they may be slower than you'd like, or they may have a higher fallout rate, et cetera. And we can in real time target the right factories and show those jobs only to the factories who are going to succeed and meet the customer's expectations.
Yeah, that's amazing. So a lot of progress in the last few years with MacroFab. Bring out your crystal ball. Tell me what you think the next 2 years might look like, Chris. I want 100% perfect prediction.
Wow. I'm a terrible prognosticator. Remember I said earlier about I like taking on projects and going back and, questioning myself and my position from 10 years earlier. Right. so the reality is I don't know for sure. Right. What I can see and what I can say based on right now, are you asking me about MacroFab or the market in general?
Well, either one, MacroFab and the market. I am curious. I do want to know about MacroFab, but I also want to get your thoughts on the manufacturing market in general. But let's start with MacroFab.
Okay, so MacroFab, that one's a little easier. And of course, I can only say so much because I cannot let out all the secret sauce out. But
I won't tell anyone. I mean, it's just between us.
Yeah, just between us. Here's my product roadmap for the next 2 years.
That'd be great. Yeah, that's great.
Really, our focus is providing more value to our customers. A lot of what we're doing now is helping customers transition products from overseas to a more nearshore perspective, whether it's in Mexico, where we're doing quite a bit of business these days, or the US. We expect to see a lot more of that happening, and we're investing a lot in that end as well. We will continue to expand the types of services and products we enable our customers to build. And that's really our focus for the next couple of years. We're on a growth trajectory, and that's where we want to stay for a while.
That's great. So you and I have talked off and on about Houston and the manufacturing ecosystem. What's your sense of how far we've come in the last 3, 4, 5 years? And what you think the future holds for Houston as it relates to manufacturing?
Yeah, so the first thing I think, I'm presuming many of our listeners here are in the manufacturing industry, so I don't have to tell them what they already know. But for the few that aren't, right, Houston is a manufacturing town. We like to say it's an oil and gas town. Well, how do you get oil and gas? You need to get out of the ground. You need tools to do that with. But we've, contrary to a lot of people's belief, we do a lot more than oil and gas manufacturing here. There's a lot of aerospace, a lot of high tech. I kind of reflect some of the electronics, you know, companies have moved out, but you know, it wasn't that long ago that Foxconn was here, right? And Flex was here. I kind of remember, you know, we talk about kind of point at the buildings on 290, and that was a compact factory, and that was a compact factory, and so on. So, but kind of thinking about, you know, where we've been over the last couple of years, we've been in a rough place, I want to say. You know, we've sort of, as a manufacturing industry, because a lot of that has been targeted at the oil patch, we've gone through a number of boom and bust cycles. You know, we saw that, what was it, 2016, you know, the last oil bust, right? You know, a lot of guys went out of business, and then next thing you know, the price is up, business is raging, and then it happens again, right? But I think that the market as a whole has seen that and has started to make some moves towards, you know, being more broad in its scope. We see a number, you know, obviously we work with a number of electronics manufacturers here, and we've seen, you know, an increasing look at more than just oil and gas customers. And, you know, how do we expand our market? And that's, of course, something that we have been, you know, very much focused on. We do try to bring a lot of business to Houston manufacturers through our platform. So where we've been for the past couple of years, I think, is starting to, you know, really get a taste of what the future is going to look like if we keep doing the same thing. But, you know, I'm really heartened by seeing projects like the spaceport. You know, even if we, you know, go all the way down to South Texas and, you know, Elon Musk's projects and the stuff happening in Austin, you know, sure, they're building chip fabs in Austin, but it's really, you know, there's still plenty of contract manufacturers there, but it's getting more expensive to run a manufacturer in Austin. So I suspect we're going to see a big knock-on effect here in Houston as those plants and facilities start producing more product and people want it assembled into their final goods.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the near term here, we have the opportunity to diversify our manufacturing base. It's sitting right in front of us. And I think as we deal with the sort of geopolitical instability and the fragility of our stretched out supply chain, as we have now seen over the past year, we're going to see a lot more business moving, if not back directly to cities like Houston, to, you know, nearby regions like Mexico that will have Houston supplying, you know, some significant, you know, value into those relationships as well. Yeah. So I'm hoping to see, you know, some of this, you know, move a little more kind of up level a little bit, right? You know, which is not to say let's all try to find, you know, how to make the cheapest products possible here in Houston. But like, let's figure out how to build the most value add here in Houston. That's really, yeah, that's really my perspective on that.
Yeah. And I love that too, Chris. I think that's exactly the right perspective to have and the right way to think about how we can bring value. So Chris, what's the best way to get in touch with you to find out more about MacroFab?
Right. So the easiest way to find out more about MacroFab is to go to macrofab.com. It's a worldwide web thing. It's great.
You kind of I've heard about it, the internet.
Don't have to talk to anyone. Yeah. And if you want to get in touch with me, I'm pretty easy to reach. I'm church@macrofab.com. I'm not going to give you my cell number because I already get enough.
No, calls. That might be a bad idea. Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, you can reach out to me there. Right. You know, if you're, you know, if someone in our audience is, you know, listening and, you know, they're asking, hey, how do I, you know, get to be a vendor on the platform, or, you know, how do I become a customer? Just reach out to either me or, you know, to say, you know, any of the contact forms on the website, and someone from our team will talk to you about the best way to, you know, really get you moving forward.
Well, that's great, Chris. Thank you so much. You know what? I'm just so happy to hear that there are people like you that are embracing long-running challenges. I think those are the best challenges to take on. And I think we've got a great opportunity to leverage that thinking into something special for Houston. So I want to thank you for your time to be here with us today on Manufacture Houston. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about what's happening at MacroFab.
Excellent. Well, Mush, thank you very much for having me.
You got it. Thank you, Chris.
This has been the Manufacture Houston podcast, brought to you by Alchemy Industrial. For more information, check out alchemyindustrial.com. If you'd like to be on the show or want to recommend someone to get on the show, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. MUSHKHAN. Mushkan. I look forward to hearing from you.